Good afternoon, everybody. Well, we might just kick off while the last few people are coming in from lunch. The topic today is transforming the life insurance industry, life-based analytics. It seems to be a nice, bold topic for after lunch if you're feeling a bit sleepy. Transformation is always exciting. The people speaking today are John King. John is an actuary and associate director in the actuaries and consultants practice for Deloitte in Australia and has been working in the financial services industry since 2000. John is originally from Ireland and worked for 6 years for a major Irish life company in Dublin before moving to Australia. After moving to Australia, he worked for 3 years at a specialist life insurance company which offered insurance and wealth management services primarily through a banking network. John joined Deloitte in 2009 and currently specialises in consulting to life insurance and financial services clients. Kim Cohen is an actuary and the Senior Product Development Manager at BT Financial Group, responsible for continual innovation and structured development of new life insurance offerings. Prior to moving into BT Life Insurance business, Kim worked for 8 years in actuarial roles. Her background as a consulting actuary with Deloitte and as BT's pricing actuary has provided a strong analytical foundation to apply to developing market-leading offerings to meet the protection needs of Australians. Most recently, Kim was the recipient of the 2012 FSC Deloitte Future Leaders Award for her paper on the impact of medical and technological advances on underwriting and claims practices. They're going to speak numerous times in front of after each other, so hopefully that will all flow nicely. Kim will speak first. My name is Brylan Cummings and I will be facilitating today. Thank you.
Thanks, Brylan. So hopefully you guys aren't too full. We'll wake you up a bit after lunch. But our topic, as Brylan mentioned, is transforming the life industry, lifestyle-based analytics. So what are we covering today? Basically, we're going to talk about what's possible. What I really want to do is bring to life analytics. So there are so many different applications. Some of them we've heard about already in the conference, so I'll try to call some of those out as well. But we really want to bring to life real-world applications, but then bring it home again, and we'll talk about the life insurance industry and how analytics can apply there in particular. And then we'll also look at how to get there. So it really is a call to action to think about how you could use analytics in your companies so that you can really take it home and have a think about what the next steps might be for you. Along the way, there'll be some hints and tips on each page, most pages anyway, which are some key insights that you might like to think about. So what is analytics? It's really about getting the right data and asking the right questions. It's all about turning data into actionable insights. Today we're focusing on using lifestyle-based characteristics rather than the traditional data that insurers collect. A survey by Lloyds and the London of both actuaries and underwriters showed that 96% of them believe that we're in for an analytical arms race, but only 37% of them felt prepared for the race ahead. So now I'm just looking for a show of arms. Who thinks that their business is ready to use analytics and to take advantage of it? A couple of people. Okay, great. So hopefully this will inspire you to have a look at it a bit more. So as I said, first we're going to talk about some broader real-world examples, and the online area is somewhere that we can really learn from. There's a wealth of data capture as clicks through a website are captured in the online space, achieving insights into customer researching and purchasing patterns. So we've got eBay up here as an example, and I've learnt that Accenture has recently worked with eBay to try to test what layout of their front page works best. So basically, they tried 4,000 different layouts of the same content. And when you logged into eBay, you randomly got a different layout. So they did this over a trial period. What they were able to achieve by choosing the best layout was a 17% increase in conversion rates. In the online space, analytics is very entrenched. In the life insurance space, it's only just growing. So we really need to look at other markets to learn. And banks are one area that are really trying to use analytics to get closer to their customer. They're grouping transactional data and customer demographics to make recommendations based on spending patterns. They're also using this data to create value-add tools for customers. As we heard yesterday, actuaries were integral in the design of People Like You for UBank, and I think that we can take some of those learnings and apply them to more traditional industries. So these tools allow you to view your own spending habits and also compare them to others, and also give you some information about relevant topics such as eating out and things like that. So, the race that stops the nation. What we really learn from the Macquarie Quant's take on using analytics and applying it to the Melbourne Cup is that you can make a lot of money out of analytics. So they've made money over the last 6 years in predicting who's going to be the winner and also betting on a box trifecta. So I don't know if you've heard about this, but they do it each year. But one thing that's interesting about their methods is they don't just plug in the data once. They look at mix the data to look at it in multiple ways. So they don't just look at the odds. They look at the odds in three different ways. So one, they look at the sentiment, which is the average odds for that horse. Two, they look at the momentum, which is the change in odds from the open of the market to the time of the race. And then three, they look at the quality, which is the dispersion in odds across all the bookmakers. In life, this is applicable by if we want to look at people's spending patterns, we might want to look at not just their fixed spending patterns, but the change in spending patterns over time. This is particularly important if we're looking at trying to identify a change in lifestyle that might trigger the need to have an insurance discussion and reconsider how much insurance they need. A little bit closer to home, general insurance has had some great advances in the UK in creating their own data to perform analytics. So Insure the Box has installed a black box in your car, and that measures how safely you drive. And then it sends that data back to the insurer so they can price. So obviously for the insurer, this is fantastic. They're able to attract better drivers by giving discounts. They're also able to reduce fraud. But even better, they're able to open the dialogue with customers more on a more continual basis and build a much stronger relationship. For customers, they're impressed by the apps they receive to help their driving standards. And they also get a fantastic claim service. One example of this is if you have an accident in an isolated rural area, no one may be along for ages to find out that you've had a serious accident. The insurer can actually see in this black box that an accident has occurred, and they can contact emergency vehicles to send them out, which can really reduce response times, which is obviously a fantastic service for the customer, but also a great public service. This little tool developed by insurers has actually improved road safety. But the most exciting part about this invention that I like is that general insurers have used it in a really innovative way to get around the gender directive in the UK. So what they've done is introduce a campaign called Drive Like a Girl. As you all know, girls are better drivers. So they've started a campaign that is targeted at aged 17 to 25-year-olds, and they're encouraged to drive like a girl, and the little black box tells the insurer if they're driving safely and can give a discount. So it's not pricing on gender, but it is kind of playing on that. So really, you can apply analytics anywhere. As we heard from Adam Drusey yesterday, he's applied it to the NRL Bulldogs, so who would have thought? But Nate Silver's applied it both to predicting the 2012 election win by Obama and also to baseball, as portrayed in the movie Moneyball. Data is also available everywhere. So I think when I click to this next slide, we're going to watch a short video, and I'll explain to you the relevance in a second. But basically, data is everywhere and sometimes right under your nose.
As a world-renowned economist and a leading expert on race in America, Fryer has long been interested in what he calls cultural segregation, the gap between white culture and black culture.
one embodiment of that culture is what you name your kid. It's probably one of the few cultural items that we can really measure precisely. What we did was we looked at the effects of your kid's first name on their life outcomes.
Dr. Fryer analyzed the naming records of every baby born in the state of California over the last 40 years, and those names tell an unmistakable story. African-American parents are more likely than any other ethnic group to give their children unique names.
There is definitely a distinction between names for white people and names for black people.
Black names be like Malik, Jaquan, Nashawn, Naheem.
Tasha and Shamika.
Shaniquas and the Nashawns and the Kayshawns.
I know this girl, her name is Treasure, T-R-E-Z-U-R-E. Struck me as typically, you know, more African-American name.
I like the names that begin with S-H-A, like Shaheem, Shahid. Shamar,
Shaquem, Shakur,
you know, Oprah, it's popular.
Now, everybody tried to do something, how do you say, unique. They tried to name their kid over something different, you know?
We had 228 unique versions of the name Unique. Again, my favorite was U-N-E-Q-Q-E-E. Another one of my favorites was U-N-E-E-K. So there are a lot of people are trying to be unique.
So what happens to all these uniquely named kids? Kids like poor little Temptress.
I think it's not the name that's doing the damage to Temptress. It's that they grow up in the type of situation where someone would name their kid Temptress. The person who actually would name their kid that probably has a host of other issues that are influencing that kid's lifetime outcomes, not just the name itself.
What kinds of issues? Well, let's look at a boy with the study's most common white name and a boy with the study's most common African-American name.
The person who gives their kid a distinctively black name, on average, is more likely to live in poverty and to be kind of on the lower rungs of the socioeconomic ladder.
You see, this is where Jake lives, and this is where Deshaun lives.
In Deshaun's neighborhood, you know, the schools are not functioning. The teachers in those schools aren't the same quality as would be in Jake's neighborhood. In those neighborhoods, 80% of the households are female-headed only. And what we found is that names don't matter so much. The type of mother you have, the type of family you have, the type of community you grow up in, those things matter a lot. But what they name you just doesn't matter.
So a name doesn't define your destiny?
maybe if you name someone Destiny, I don't know. But no, I mean, the your name doesn't define your destiny.
So even though your name might not define your destiny, it might define how you're treated in life insurance. Let's see. We'll explore that. But basically, I just wanted to highlight that a name, which is something we collect for every insurance policy we have, is something that we could use to try to identify whether that tells us something about the customer. There's lots of data we know about customers today that we just don't use. And it's really about taking that data and doing some analytics and seeing if that tells us something. And potentially it'll mean we'll need to ask them less questions that we don't know about them by just using the data we already have. So one example of that is I've always found it a little bit odd that in group insurance, we'll price a group based on the characteristics of that group, and often occupation is a big impact on that. So a group of miners versus a group of accountants likely to have a different price on their group death rates. But in retail insurance, we only price on age and gender and smoking status. We don't price based on occupation, so we don't really take that into account. We just charge them all the same price. So there are things that we currently have today that we could be using more, but I'm going to hand over to John to talk a little bit more about how we could apply data analytics to life insurance.
Hi, everyone. So Kim has given us a good overview of the application of analytics, and it reaches far and wide in other industries, and it's already being used extensively. What I'll be doing is taking you through a little bit more about how it can and has been used successfully in the life insurance industry. So this slide here covers off the more common areas where this has been used, sort of across the life cycle of a policy, if you want to look at it that way. In terms of people's propensity to buy insurance, how we can use analytics to improve strike rates or conversion rates for those new potential policies. In terms of selling, how you may want to structure your distribution force and improve the online experience for customers. In terms of the propensity to claim and how you might want to apply perhaps a triage approach to underwriting, And finally, in terms of the management of your in-force portfolio and ensuring that you're allocating your resources most effectively in your efforts to minimise policyholders from lapsing. So what data analytics enables insurers to do is to increase the effectiveness of the teams responsible for these areas so that they can prioritise the use of their scarce resources and to make sure that they're working in the most efficient way. And with this ability to better understand and identify with their customers, insurers can tailor their interactions so that they're more relevant to their needs, and hopefully then unnecessary communications can be minimised and leading to better customer experience. So looking first at marketing. Marketing is an area where I think data analytics has a natural fit. It's already outside of the insurance industry. This is probably the most common application of analytics. And it's easy to imagine that it extends naturally to the sale of insurance policies. In this case, effectively this involves the identifying people within your marketing database who are more likely to take up a policy if it's being offered to them. And in the chart here, this is represented by those in the, let's try this thing here. Yep, the right-hand quadrants here. So more likely to take up a policy once it's been offered to them. In its simplest terms, this might be identifying a new couple that's moved from the city to the suburbs and perhaps started including nappies in their weekly spending. So life-changing event might want to, more inclined to take up a new policy. But when we consider the volumes of data that credit card companies and supermarket loyalty companies are collecting on people every day, and I mean it must be staggering, the possibilities to fine-tune this picking out of people is endless, I think. But the real power of analytics comes when we combine the ability to identify with the ability to assess the risks of those people. So maybe if we can rate people by their health, we can also see who are more likely to qualify for the insurance in the event that they take up the insurance. That's represented on the top quadrants here. So most likely to qualify in the event that they actually apply for the insurance. And then you get the targeting the optimal customers, which I think would be these ones here. So highest in terms of propensity to buy and also highest in terms of qualifying for the insurance. You basically get the biggest bang for your buck from a limited marketing budget, and we all have budgets to work with. You can reduce your per policy acquisition costs by maximising your strike rate. This has flow-on effects to premium rates, so policyholders will benefit from this too. And also potentially increasing your cross-sell rates and increasing the bond between the insurer and the policyholder. The next stage I'll look at is, in the case of the management of in-force portfolio, I'll focus on the use of analytics in terms of optimising retention efforts. So it's possible, and I think anybody who works in retention will understand that it's actually possible to identify, it's possible to identify policyholders who are about to lapse by monitoring their activity around the premium payment dates. This might be activities such as those who cancelled their direct debit authorizations, in the case of surrender value policies, someone who's ringing up a lot finding out what their surrender value is going to be. So it's, you know, we can see when this is happening. However, rather than the insurer putting equal efforts into all policyholders that show signs of lapsing, there's another dimension which is worth overlaying here, and that is to identify the relative value of different policyholders. One approach may be to look at the customer lifetime value across all products, not just the life, and to focus your retention efforts on those policyholders which potentially higher value to the group. Another maybe more sophisticated approach, again, might be to reassess the policyholder's health, effectively to re-underwrite at the point of lapse. So all policyholders will have successfully passed through their underwriting before taking out the policy, but the selection effect wears off over time. So if you can identify the healthier lives in your portfolio, represented, I think, by the top brackets here, then you can get the most out of your retention efforts by focusing on the healthier policyholders who look like they're about to lapse. And similarly, for those with a lower score in terms of health and also displaying signs of imminent lapse, well, you may decide just not to act in those situations and just focus your efforts elsewhere where they're going to be more fruitful. So I'll hand back to Kim now for a bit.
Thanks, John. So we've had a look at propensity to buy and propensity to lapse. Now I'll look at propensity to claim. So as you all know, we hope anyway, the amount of claims we have is far fewer than the amount of people we underwrite. So one of the best ways that we look at to determine propensity to claim is looking at what the underwriting outcome is and using analytics to try to replicate that outcome. So if we have a look at this graph, basically it shows you can use analytics to split applications into different scores. So along the bottom there's different scores. And if you've got a low score, you'll have a high likelihood to have a loading or a decline. And if you've got a high model score, then you've got a low likelihood of having a loading or a decline. So what we could do there is take this lower group of people and think, well, okay, they're not very healthy, so we need to put them through our full underwriting process. In my opinion today, it's particularly in the advice space, most underwriting is developed with the worst case in mind. So we take a person and think, you know, they could be really sick, they, you know, we think that they might be the most unhealthy person, and we quite rigorously underwrite them. So we continue to treat these people in the same way we do today. But these other people that we think that potentially are healthier, we could offer them a streamlined underwriting process. So in the US, that's meant taking away medicals for those people. So I guess the US market is quite different to the Australian market. And even at above $100,000, some insured, they start doing mandatory medicals. So they've achieved some significant improvements in cost savings and also turnaround times in putting through underwriting by undertaking this method. But we could do it in our market more by asking fewer questions. And that's definitely happened in different markets around the world. We spoke with someone in the UK who'd managed to cut it down to 2 questions online. And they actually had to stop that pilot program because their advisors got upset that there was some channel conflict there. So it can be too successful, but they are re-looking at that. So I think there's huge value in streamlining underwriting in the current market. Really, customers are starting to move away from the intermediated channels. After the GFC, they're really questioning the value of advice, and we're starting to see them move more online and into a self-directed way. But insurers are also trying to move away from just focusing on the high net worth and affluent individuals and trying to capture more of the mass market. And to do that, they really need efficiency in the underwriting, so this analytical approach can really help with that. Also, as alliances grow, insurers can get more and more access to lifestyle-based data. So you may have heard earlier this month that Woolies bought half of Quantium. So I'm sure Quantium, even though obviously they already had a relationship with Woolies, will benefit from getting all that, was it 7 terabytes of data on all the, you know, everyday rewards, loyalty card, all the expenditure that's happening in there, and all that information will be really handy. Again, there's also Priceline selling insurance, and they've got lots of information on their points cards about what people are buying, different vitamins and things that can also be used. Underwriting triage is tried and tested in the US, so we can really learn from overseas markets. Deloitte in particular has applied with a handful of insurers over in the US, and they've combined both traditional insurance data with lifestyle-based customer data from marketers like the loyalty schemes that I mentioned. They've also proven their accuracy, testing very large samples of apps. So they'd use, in this example, they took 60,000 applications and split it in two. They used 30,000 to run their model and get their predictive variables. And then they applied that model to the other 30,000 of applications and tested whether they could achieve the same outcome. And basically, in most cases, they did achieve the same outcome. But where they didn't achieve the same outcome, they did some investigation and they found that in half the cases where they were wrong, it was because the underwriter had made a business decision to accept the policy on a kind of going against their standard underwriting approach and more maybe taking into account the needs of the advisor or trying to win that sort of business. So that was really interesting and comforting that the model was quite accurate. Yes, let's move on. So basically, I don't know if any of you went to the holistic business case discussion just then, but analytics really helps you make a holistic business case as it helps everyone. So the customer in particular, it helps. And I think customers are coming to expect us as an industry to move more towards this streamlining underwriting approach. So this is already evident today in banks, where I've seen BankSA recently advertise a 60-second approval process for personal loans over your mobile phone. So they're obviously using a pre-assessment based on existing data, and they can get through that loan process in 60 seconds. If they don't have that information of you, you'll just go through this standard credit checking process. And I guess we're just talking about using something similar for life insurance. The claims, actually, even though most business cases for applying underwriting triage include an allowance for an additional claims costs, early indications are that claims are actually better than expected, and that can be explained by the fact that healthier lives are getting through the process a lot quicker, which means that there are fewer that are not proceeded with, so many more of the healthy lives get on the books and stay on the books, and so that's actually helping the claims experience. The sellers of insurance, they really appreciate this advancement. They don't have to spend lots of time asking intrusive underwriting questions, very personal questions. Instead, they can focus on building that customer relationship. And the underwriters also satisfied by this approach. They can bypass looking at all the healthy lives and really focus on the complex disclosures of the less healthy lives. So if lifestyle-based data is so good at helping us make decisions about who's healthy and who's not healthy, then why are we just using it to streamline underwriting? Why aren't we using it to price? So I guess that's a good question. I'm posing it myself and I'll answer it myself, but I guess I don't have the answer, and it would be good to ponder it, but I think we're looking at testing with underwriting first. So I think it's a good risk management approach to kind of give it a test first before we fully leap in. But we are seeing general insurers using this sort of information to price, and our counterparts in loans. So it is something that we could consider. But I think life insurance have some additional considerations that we need to look at. The first, I would say, is insurance is about pooling risks. If you break down a market into very small groups and start pricing based on them, you lose some of that pooling and that cross-subsidy. So we really need to think as an industry how granular we want to get in charging specific prices. And I think the other thing which is most important is to consider what data we think is valid to use to price a policy. So to me, you can look at these in two different categories. One is looking at facts. So age and gender are facts. You can't change them if you tried. I guess you can, but we do deal with them separately. But we'll ignore that case. I only just thought of that. So there's no anti-selection there. People aren't going to change their age to get a better price on their insurance because they can't do that. Although, actually, maybe you can do that as well if you're printing your own organs. But anyway, I'm ignoring all those future advances. But I think the other type of data we could use to price is if it encourages better risk. So it really needs to be, in my opinion, a causal link. So we already price based on smoking status. We can see evidence that if you smoke, you have a worse health outcome. In general insurance, if you have an alarm on your car, we will charge you less. If you build in a flood zone, we'll charge you more, but it's all just to encourage you to have a better risk profile. And if you built up on a hill and you were nice and protected from the floods, we'll charge you less, and that's encouraging the right behaviour. But is it really appropriate to identify the fact that if you have less than 15 ATM transactions a month or more than 40 ATM transactions a month, then you're more likely to be loaded or declined, and therefore we're going to charge you more? Is that going to mean that people just start using the ATM the right amount of times and then they'll get a better price on their insurance? They can anti-select against us, and it kind of goes against that causal link. But I'll let you think about what you think's appropriate as in data to price on. So now we'll look at location. So in one of the plenaries yesterday, Diana had a talk about how Amy introduced location into their pricing, and it is something that we could do in insurance as well. Deloitte has put a lot of effort into getting some detailed ABS mortality and census data and overlaying this, And they've looked at what mortality rates by age and gender tell us we should expect mortality to be in a geographic sense. What they found was that out, let me point, in these western suburbs, so Bosley Park and Mount Druitt, they had much worse mortality than expected. And in the North Shore up here, they had, and also down in Sutherland actually, maybe surprisingly, they had better than expected mortality. So that's a really interesting outcome. So they let the data do the talking and showed that about half the variation in actual to expected mortality that you get from just using age and gender alone was actually explained by adding in the location variable. So they let the data do the talking, but then they overlaid their own logic and tried to explain the trends that came up. And they found some really logical reasons why the mortality varied by location. Some, there was like a low proximity to a GP, so if you had to travel more than 10 kilometres to a GP, that had a big impact on the mortality rate. Also, where there was lead in a soil near a mine, not only did the miners potentially have higher mortality, but also everyone who lived in that area. And it also indicated socioeconomic advantage. And it also showed that there are similar lifestyle factors by geography. So diabetes and cardiovascular disease might be more concentrated in different areas due to maybe more active lifestyles or less active lifestyles. But yeah, so maybe location is one area that we could use to price in life insurance, but I'll let you think about that. Back to John to talk about how you could actually do this analytics.
So this is the, I suppose, what we look at as the life cycle of introducing an analytical model, and we go through in a little bit of detail now about the different steps. First of all, defining what you want to do, why you're going to engage in this work, or what are you trying to achieve. So decide how you're going to use the model, what specific outcomes are you trying to predict, and what particular segments of, you know, the policyholder member base that you're trying to identify with. Knowing the financial impact to the organisation, if you're successful, will help formulate your business case and also help with stakeholder buy-in. So it's good to be clear on what you're trying to get out of this process. But a lot of this comes down to the data. And Kim has touched on a few things already. So maybe just if we just backtrack a little bit. In terms of understanding the risk profile of a particular customer, traditionally insurers were limited to what they were able to collect on the original application form and also through any medical tests. But given the data explosion that's happened in recent years, there's now much more available and we can supplement and even replace some of this. So for example, census data, which Kim touched on, can provide information on the relative mortality, the average family size, marital status or occupation or employment prospects for particular geographic locations. Insurers within banking groups possibly have an advantage if they can potentially access millions of bank transactions or credit card transactions, which will provide an insight into the socioeconomic status or whether someone has particular spending habits or saving habits. Any alliances with supermarkets or other loyalty programs will obviously provide access to large member databases and also detailed characteristics of the lifestyle characteristics of those members. And also, I think, when you think about my iPhone, which has a GPS and calls on it, I'm not sure what Apple are collecting from me. I'm not too sure on that one. But even things like Google and Facebook, you know, there's obviously their business is actually data. They pretend to be search engines, but I think they're a lot more than that. This quote here I thought was quite interesting. So I came across this by accident, actually, and I thought it was a fitting example of just how much data is actually being stored. Anybody who has a Kindle will know that you can highlight passages as you work through the books or whatever. And I came across on the Amazon website that they actually rank the most popular of quotes that has been highlighted. So this was in the top 10 or the top 20, but slightly relevant. I won't bother reading it out there, but just goes to show just how deep that the data that's being stored, and this is just scratching the surface. So on the next slide, so once we've got our data sources identified, the next step is in building and testing the predictive model. So effectively this involves, systematically working through your different data items and objectively assessing whether there's a correlation between what they are saying and the target variable that you're trying to predict. So in the example of underwriting, which we touched on before, this might mean for a given data item, what value did we see more often than not in the cases that we accepted people through underwriting versus those that were declined. So obviously there's predictive power in that particular variable, whatever it may be. And data which provides the highest correlations will probably make their way through to the final predictive model. Maybe in more sophisticated versions of this, you could combine several data sources together to, you know, to really ramp up the predictive ability of any particular variables. And while the analytical tools are very powerful, there's still, it's nice to know there's still a place for experienced professionals here. For one client, I was assessing the impact of certain socioeconomic factors on mortality. An interesting but probably not that surprising statistic that came out of the first draft of the model was that a lot of the dead people happen to have zero bank balances. So maybe not that surprising, but just goes to show you can't just turn the handle on the model and use what comes out. There's still a place for knowledgeable and you know, informed people to decide whether or not the outcome is insightful and worth continuing with. And testing of these models is then, I think, like what Kim touched on before, effectively it needs to be replicable and to be able to reproduce the same outcomes on another sample test case. So effectively applying the algorithm to a new data set and making sure that you can accurately predict the outcome, or you can understand to the extent that there might be variations. And you know, even if there are variations, maybe that's within your risk appetite to continue with it, or you can fine-tune your model slightly based on that. So just in the tip at the bottom there, no preconceived notions about the predictive variables. So I think as actuaries, we're trained to know which are the important variables which determine someone's likelihood to die or claim or whatever it may be. But the beauty of an analytical model is that it's unbiased, so it will rigorously assess the data and should come up with which are the statistically credible parameters or variables which lead to an insight into that target outcome. And obviously being unbiased will potentially provide some new insights that might not be front of mind. You know, Kim mentioned a number of ATM transactions, but you can see just how far that can be taken. Okay. So once you've modelled it and tested it, then you need to implement it into your business. So this may involve applying your tested algorithm to a relevant consumer group, effectively to stratify them into different segments. And then, for example, you may stratify prospective customers into those who are most healthy, least likely to lapse, and most likely to buy based on the data you already have on them, or alternatively stratify your existing customers based on their likelihood to lapse. And then implementing the changes to business processes, you may target those customers in healthy segments that are least likely to lapse with marketing or other advisor incentives. Alternatively, maybe don't try to actively retain existing customers where the customer is in an unhealthy group, we mentioned previously, but focus your retention efforts on those which are, you know, obviously higher or have higher customer lifetime value to the extent that you are able to identify that. And also you may decide just from implementing these new technologies that you're able to remove some of your questions from your traditional underwriting form, so not, you know, asking the question to a policyholder when you can get the information through other methods, or it can be replaced from other data sources. And finally, I think we need to keep in mind that, you know, like the actuarial control cycle, we need to be mindful that, you know, these are live people, you know, their behaviours change, times change, technologies change, data changes. So what might work now might not be relevant so much in 5 years' time. So we need to be constantly mindful that the process remains valid. So it will require a refresh from time to time. So finally, just to wrapping it up, so where do we go to from here? So this is a technology which, although widely used in other industries, I think is still in its infancy in terms of its application for life insurance in Australia. There's a number of legal and ethical and privacy concerns which we'll obviously need to be very careful about and how we treat them and how we can overcome them. And the slide above lists some of the other challenges that we're likely to face, whether we act now or don't act now. But the potential upsides from incorporating this technology, I think, are very significant, with better performing portfolios, reducing costs, and all the benefits that flows through to the business and also to policyholders, as we mentioned previously, potentially reducing rates, less annoying contacts from offers that they don't want anyway. And I think it's just helpful just to consider when the life insurance industry first started offering preferential rates to smokers, very quickly preference rates to non-smokers, I should say. Very quickly, all the other insurers had to quickly catch up, or they were going to be left with a portfolio full of smokers happy to pay average premium rates. So when this eventually becomes embedded in the decision-making processes, or the toolkit at least, for insurance companies, I think it's going to be a disruptor to the industry. So for those of you unsure how to proceed, myself and Kim were thinking the proposed solution is just to pilot this for now and see what it does for your organisation and what benefits you can achieve, and hopefully you can make it a strategic decision which works for you and your business, and see how best to incorporate it. So that brings us to the end. Happy to take any questions on that.
Does anyone have any examples of applying analytics to life insurance? One of the problems I guess we saw when researching this was you can really easily use analytics and no one else knows. So you can, I guess there's reflexive questioning in underwriting today, so you could implicitly be using analytics without anyone being able to see that, or you could be marketing to the right people without anyone being able to see that, or you could be calling the right people to stop them lapsing and not the unhealthy people, but it's very difficult from an outsider to actually see if an insurer is using this unless they make that widely available. So,
And I think in the case of the loans that Kim mentioned, were obviously from, so I think St. George, you said that we're offering 60-second turnaround for existing customers. So, we basically looked at and said there's no way that they could be doing that without already leveraging the data that they have, but. Otherwise, it's very hard to see when it's actually been used. So, interested, I suppose, to see what, if anything, people's experiences have been so far in implementing this. And I think it's as early days in Australia, but definitely is happening.
Oh, sorry. Can you please go and use the mic up there? Thank you.
Sorry, we can't hear you now. Just try again. You can come up here and talk, right? Hopefully this isn't a deterrent for the next question.
It was just a comment that I know that some European insurers use hate as a proxy for gender. And also some of our research shows that hate is correlated with your attitude towards risk-taking. So, yes. Taller people are more willing to take risks, actually. So.
Sorry about that.
I think there was some research done by the Society of Actuaries in the US in about the past year or so, where they asked a lot of life companies what they were doing in terms of data analytics. And I think it's probably the same case as for Australia, where most companies are interested, they're excited, they're looking at it, but virtually none of them have actually done anything about it yet.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say, the US have a lot more advanced in this industry, and partly because they have extra advantages in terms of the privacy rules or lack thereof. So there's a lot more marketing data that you can get for a specific person in the US, which doesn't necessarily exist here, so maybe part of the reason why it's a little bit slower to adopt over here. But I think we've just listed a few of the potentially numerous data sources that still exist in Australia, so just because you don't have the same degree of detail about a specific person doesn't mean that you can't apply a lot of what we just talked about to the Australian market already. But yes, definitely the US is probably the forefront of this at the moment, I think.
Uh, Hello, yeah, I've just come back from the UK, where Aviva's doing quite some really very interesting stuff in that analytics, both on the general insurance side and the life insurance side. On the life insurance side, in collaboration with Swiss Re, we've got a distribution deal with Royal Bank of Scotland, and so we've been trawling the files of RBS plus data from outside both organisations to come up with pre-populated offers to clients, requiring, I think, just one question. We're now down to one question. It's pretty spectacular stuff because it pops up and it's there and it's relevant to clients and it looks pretty easy. On the general insurance side, it's fantastic what's going on. You referred to some of them, but telematics, for example, Aviva was one of the companies that tried the telematics idea of sort of 4 or 5 years ago, and with the black box and all that sort of thing, but didn't work, didn't get take up and all that sort of thing. But you're quite right, this is now moving quite steadily in the UK. And we just released an app earlier this year for the Android phones, not for the iPhone, because the iPhone's not as accurate, as it turns out, as the Android stuff at the moment. But you download the app for free, and then you're encouraged to put it in your car and drive around with it for 200 miles. You clock up 200 miles. At the end of the 200 miles, there's enough data. We've got enough data to see how you've driven in terms of cornering, braking and acceleration, all that sort of thing. And we believe we've got enough information then to give you a premium rate, compared to the standard rate for your motor insurance policy. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, it's experimental at this stage, but it's real and it's happening at the moment. And the telematics thing is very serious, particularly as machinery is going to be embedded in cars in a couple of years' time in the UK. The other one is real-time rating, using analytics for real-time rating. We've got an online motor insurer there called Quote Me Happy, which is purely online, and it gathers information as you're putting the application up onto the web, and it gathers information and it works out based on what it can tell from what you put in yourself, plus other information, other sources of data, whether the client or the applicant is less or more likely to purchase some of the add-on covers. And if the client looks like the client's more likely to purchase the add-on covers, the basic premium rate is reduced in real time, because you've got more chance then of getting a total profit out of the contract. Credit rating has been used as a motor insurance variable in Canada first, and Aviva pioneered that in Canada and got a real break on the market there, and then brought that to the UK. And it took a number of years for other competitors to catch up to that. But it does raise issues about whether you should be allowed to use credit rating or not, and that's a debate that's raging. So it's a very exciting time. I think in North America, as you say, there's a lot of stuff going on, and this Aviva General Insurance Company over there in Canada, I think we've got about 30 or 35 actuaries in Montreal, just pouring over the data all the time. We've got pretty sophisticated underwriting for household insurance, based on all sorts of information, and now extending that to commercial insurance and trying to rate by peril, look at the various perils that make up the cover, and then taking into account literally thousands of variables to give you a more scientific approach. So it's an exciting time. Very good feel for actuaries.
Hmm. Yeah, thank you very much. Yep. Yeah, it's interesting because obviously UE has kind of opened up the market to ask a whole bunch more questions in the general insurance space, which to price on. So we can definitely leverage that. But we spoke with a UK insurer who is also linked to a bank, and they actually were able to cut down to one question for half of all applicants that they thought were healthy. But they actually did some customer research after that, that the customers actually didn't feel confident in the insurance because they weren't asked enough questions and they didn't think there was enough rigor around it. So it is interesting. You have to be a little bit careful there. So it's between the UE and the one question, somewhere in between. Sorry, did you want to quickly ask a question?
It's not so much a question as an observation. Part of the principle of insurance is some form of community rating, and it's grown that way simply because we didn't have all of this particular data. Having all of this data to a certain extent moves beyond community rating, and we've seen it talked about, especially on health insurance. You know, if you've got the BRCA gene, the wrong one, then okay, it's very hard to get, you know, extremely expensive life insurance and the like. So we really have to watch out for some of the social downsides of this sort of thing. As a mathematician, statistician, I think this is absolutely brilliant. But we've got the downside of a move away from community rating, And I don't think enough people have actually thought about that from a macroeconomic perspective. We also have the downside that is being talked about in some political circles, in that there is a very large amount of data out there that is now being used or can be used by inappropriate authorities. And this is, you know, sort of being looked at targeting people under more autocratic regimes, you know, to use a word that I got picked up on yesterday, looking for possible subversives in an inappropriate way. Yes, Kate, thank you for picking me up on that. But yes, so we have to be very careful of that. And it's not only governments that can trawl through this. You know, I mean, Google says do no evil. But, hell, that's only the people in charge of Google at the moment. You know, imagine if Rupert Murdoch took it over. But, yeah, we just have to be... we have to have a lot of social discussion and political discussion about this. But yeah, mathematically, statistically, it's beautiful work.
Definitely agree.
Oh, and all remember Harry Seldon.
Yeah, so it's definitely, it's between, do we go towards health insurance, which is community rating, or do we go towards general insurance, which has thousands of variables to price on? At the moment, life is in between. We could go one way or the other. And you've got to consider the holistic picture when doing that, because you could lose a lot of market share if you did it the wrong way. Anyway, thank you very much, everyone.
Yep. Great.